Well, good morning, happy Thursday, and welcome to Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Sure appreciate your dialing in there on the radio waves, and if you would like to be a part of the conversation via telephone, you can get in touch with us at 414-1234, our local number. It's 800-926-8809. If long distance from you to us, perspectives@wfsu.org is the email address, and you can tweet us at WFSU Perspective. You know, it's only been a matter of weeks since the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed the federal health care exchange component of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. And the simple question that kind of still floats in the atmosphere is, now what? A lot of the initial uncertainties, will this survive, will it not, will it reemerge in some kind of modified form, is a little bit more clear perhaps today than it was before that ruling. But there still are a lot of uncertainties and so many questions that are hanging out there. So we have a phenomenal panel of experts on Perspectives this morning to get into some of those areas of contemporary health care and what the future may bring from a number of perspectives. So you got to meet these guys. First off is John Howard with Rogers Gunter Vaughn Insurance right here in Tallahassee. And full disclosure, I am one of the policyholders, but not through my employer. You guys got my home insurance, and thank you very much, John. But you cover or handle the employer health care provision, right?
That's right. Yes, I handle the group medical coverage for mostly Tallahassee area employers.
Okay. And how many employers are we talking about there? Pretty sizable chunk?
The firm handles more than 100 different employers here in town.
Wow. That's a lot of group plans.
It is. Employers from as small as one to more than 3,000.
Wow. That is terrific. Well, that still comprises a huge chunk, I think, of the total insurance market locally. So can't wait to bend your ear on that and get a perspective from you. We also say hi to Rose Knapp, who is CEO of Florida Health Choices and very plugged into this whole thing. Rose, good to see you.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here.
And as far as Florida Health Choices, for the folks who don't know what that organization is, please enlighten.
Certainly. It's an exchange created by the state for Floridians. So right now we're offering strictly individual coverage, and we're offering it statewide. It's an online, open 24/7 shopping experience.
And we will be talking about some of those options and choices coming up in just a little bit, Rose. We also welcome to these microphones Jason Altmaier. And you can't talk about health insurance in Florida without talking about Florida Blue, which is the largest single provider of health insurance in the state. And Jason, we should call you Congressman because you also represented Pennsylvania's 4th District in Congress as a Democrat from 2007 until 2013. You were right in the thick of that whole debate over the Affordable Care Act, right?
I was. I was there. And because I came from a health care background, that was something I participated in the debate every step of the way and went all the way through it. So here we are.
Well, before you you jumped into that race for the 4th from Kittenning right there on the Allegheny River northeast of Pittsburgh, what was your avocation?
I had worked – a master's in health administration. I'd worked in the hospital industry immediately before.
Give us some insight. What was that debate like? Because we certainly followed it here through NPR and through other news providers and all of that, but it looked like it was one of the – certainly most protracted, but also one of the nastiest knockdown, drag-out fights that we'd seen in Congress in a long, long time.
I think it has to be. Historically, if you look at where we were in the beginning of President Obama's term, we had just had 6 months where the average job loss per month was 750,000 jobs lost per month over a six-month period. The economy appeared to be in free fall. The GDP loss for the last quarter of 2008 was minus 6.5%. So health care was put forward as an economic bill, a way to help jumpstart the economy. And President Obama surrounded himself with a lot of people who learned from the Clinton failure in the effort to do health care reform. President Clinton famously excluded all the special interests from the debate – doctors, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, medical device industry, even consumer groups like the AARP. They were excluded under President Clinton's law or a bill, which never became law because of that, because of the opposition of those groups. President Obama took the opposite approach. He brought in all the special interests and he cut deals with them, asking, what can we do to help ensure, if not at least your support, your neutrality in this, so you wouldn't see those commercials targeting it. And because of those deals that were cut, in the end, the bill, which is now the law, does a very good job of covering everybody. Now, the Supreme Court subsequently struck the Medicaid provision, but in the original law, almost everybody in America was covered. It didn't do as much as it could have on quality of care and some of the other issues that were involved in health care, mostly lowering the cost. So we cover a lot of people. We don't do as great a job with the cost. And that has great instruction for what we do in the future here, because the private market has now picked up the baton to run down the track of negotiating deals to reduce the cost of health care, because there wasn't as much of that in the law as there could have been.
Okay. I think that there was also a lot of talk and speculation and perhaps a little fear-mongering that was going on that the passage of Obamacare would result in a wholesale shift of the insurance market from what had been to what would be, which as some folks were saying was a takeover of 1/6 of the U.S. economy and we'd all be on some kind of Medicare. But John Howard, that did not happen. Still, employer-provided health insurance is a huge part of the market and people did not have to change carriers or change policies, even though some did. Most didn't, right?
Seems to me like here in Tallahassee in particular, we didn't see much change when it came to that. When it comes to certain – from what I've read, that's all how I can respond. It's around the country. There were some shifts, but here locally we didn't see much change in that area.
Now, I know that because, again, full disclosure, my wife and I have been on CHP probably since 1983 when our private sector employer began offering it. We saw no changes whatsoever. Occasional adjustments in premium, of course, as the employer paid less and the employee was expected to pay more. But that's been across the board pretty much, hasn't it?
It has. Actually, Capital Health Plan has been just done a stellar job throughout this whole process.
Okay. Well, Rosanna, from your viewpoint, though, since we're talking about choices, what other choices are available if you are not receiving insurance through your employer, like John and his guys do, if you are not on one of the policies provided by, in the case of Florida, the federal exchange, since we don't have a state exchange here, and you are not Medicare, what else is there?
Well, certainly the private market still offers individual coverage and there are private exchanges that don't offer subsidies. And I think a lot of people, for whatever reason, think that the federal exchange is the place where most Floridians buy. And it's not. You know, we've got almost 20 million Floridians. There's 1.3 million who purchase through the federal exchange. The rest of the insurance market is working through private exchanges or through their private agent. But I do want to mention, you talked about, I personally received under the Affordable Care Act cancellation of my coverage.
Ah, okay.
And right at the very end there in December, and on December 1st, I believe, right before it took effect. And I was able to replace it with some other coverage, but I was one of those few people that actually got a cancellation and had to shift.
And the horror stories that came out from some of the people who went through that sort of experience was that they got less coverage and higher deductibles and heftier premiums and all that sort of thing.
My premium went down and I had the exact same coverage.
Okay. And Congressman, that's what, again, we had heard from many people, this parade of horribles that might occur once the ACA took effect. And there certainly has been some of that, but that seems to be counterbalanced by a lot of folks who had even better options than they did before.
The cancellations that occurred were because there's a minimum benefits package that must be offered under the law to every person who buys health insurance. So things that you didn't have in your plan before, let's say mental health coverage, expanded pharmaceutical benefit, even maternity and child coverage. If you're a 59-year-old male, you're going to have to buy a plan with maternity coverage in it because it's required under the law. So now that that has sorted itself out, all the plans are compliant, you've seen costs go up at a historically lower rate of cost increase than we've ever seen in the healthcare industry. And regardless of where you were 5 years ago when the law was being debated in the Congress, I think it's pretty safe to say many of the sky is falling rhetorical questions that were raised have not proven to be true.
If you're just joining us on Perspectives, we're talking about health care in the wake of the second U.S. Supreme Court decision, which gave the go-ahead to or reaffirmed, actually, the federal exchange and the ability for subsidizing policies under the federal exchange. Wayne is joining us here on the line. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I live down on the Gulf Coast, and I've been extremely disappointed in some of the exclusions and requirements of the Affordable Care Act. I love the notion of it, but long before the ACA, I went to Blue Cross Blue Shield, and since 2005 have paid for my own major medical policy. I make too much money to hit the subsidized threshold and can pay for most of my own medical bills. For 2 years in a row, I received congratulatory letters from Florida Blue telling me my insurance plan met the ACA requirements, but 2 weeks ago have received a handful of notices now that they're discontinuing that program as of August 1st. And my rate will almost triple overnight. So by being responsible and taking care of my own health coverage for now 10 years running with zero claims, I must rejoin the ranks of the uninsured on August 1st, and I'm very disappointed. Perhaps the lady has some advice where I should be looking besides Big Blue.
Well, certainly Florida Health Choices has options. I think in your area there are about 13 different plans that you could choose from. You can go to myfloridachoices.org and shop at your pleasure. There's a number there you can call, or you can chat with one of our agents. Of course, a local insurance agent there would also be able to help you. So I hope that was helpful.
But I know that individual plans are just – they are more expensive than group coverage or certainly subsidized coverage, which Wayne says he does not qualify for anymore. So there are winners. There are losers still.
Yeah. Health care and health insurance is very personal, and everyone's experience is going to be different.
You're listening to Perspectives on WFSU-FM, and we have a great panel of folks who are involved in healthcare and healthcare coverage. And we invite your participation, too, at 414-1234 or 800-926-8809. We'll be right back. Back on Perspectives, and a reminder, you can always find Perspectives online at WFSU.org. Go to WFSU.org, click on radio, pull down the programs menu, and click Perspectives, because we archive past shows and try to have the latest program up within a few hours of when it actually airs. So we'll actually be able to go back and hear ourselves today. Isn't that great, guys? Couple questions here, and Congressman Altmaier, if I can ask you here, since we were talking about Florida Blue, with Florida Blue being the dominant or in some cases the only insurer for the ACA in North Florida, how does that affect what people pay? I think some folks are concerned that, oh, well, you guys are a virtual monopoly, then you're going to be soaking customers, et cetera, et cetera.
Interestingly, in Florida, it's about the most competitive health insurance market of any state in the country. There are 10 to 12 carriers depending on which county you live in. And we're in all 67 counties in Florida Blue. Statewide, we're a little bit over 30% market share. But, you know, Aetna, United, Cigna, Humana, they're right on our tail. And in some counties, we don't even have the majority of the market. In North Florida, where we are now, Tallahassee is a unique circumstance. We have the state contract. Capital Health Plan is a subsidiary of Florida Blue. There's so many state employees. So it's a little bit of a unique circumstance. However, those are competitively bid contracts. You have to win that based upon offering the best deal. So I think the competition that exists in the bidding process results in the best price and the best product for the consumer.
Well, John Howard, if I could ask you this then, people are always concerned though about rate increases, and we have seen that historically. There has been a shift from fully provided employer plans to more and more of a share being picked up by the employees. And that, even though the overall increase in costs may be mitigated somewhat by the ACA, that trend's likely to continue, right? We're going to be paying more over time.
Yes. There is a what's called a Milliman Index that's produced each year, and it breaks down the cost of the employer, typical cost for the employer paid portion, the employee portion, and the out-of-pocket expense. And in 2014, it's the first year a family of four will spend on average $25,000, including the employer's portion of the premium, the employee's portion, and the deductibles and out-of-pocket expenses. And that's just a huge expense. And although I don't, the second part of your question, I've spoken now with Jason a couple of times. I think this is our third time together. I'm not seeing any change or reduction in the increases each year. I delivered yesterday five different increases or five different group plan renewals yesterday, and all three were double-digit increases following the previous year's double-digit increase. It's a real struggle for the employer today to be able to figure out how to pay the additional cost plus salary increases and so forth without passing on too much to the employee.
And Rosenaff, I know that there are folks who are saying, well, isn't the Florida Office of Insurance Regulation now to protect us from these ongoing increases in health care coverage costs?
So I think some of the really interesting features of the Affordable Care Act, one of them included minimum loss ratios. So there is no incentive for an insurance company to overcharge its customers if they don't spend a very high percentage, I think it's 85% of some products, directly on healthcare services. That only leaves 15% for administration and networks and websites and marketing and all the operations, paying the claims. So there is no incentive for a company to overcharge. And we do have the insurance office and regulators who oversee the plans.
Okay. And Congressman Allmayer, that was what I was wondering, because one of the alternatives or modifications to the ACA we kept hearing primarily from Republican folks was, if we just get rid of state regulation of health care coverage and let people purchase across state lines and that kind of thing, that would drive down premiums for folks, or would that just eliminate state regulation along those lines?
A lot of that, with the consolidation you're seeing in the market, has become somewhat of a moot point. That was an argument that maybe had a little bit more resonance 5 years ago. But people generally want their own state insurance commissioner to have the ultimate say in the product that they're getting. I think people get uncomfortable when you start taking away the right of the state to regulate their own insurance products. Again, here in Florida, especially, we have an incredibly competitive market. People are seeing rates based upon that competition. So I don't think interstate sales would make a difference here.
414-1234 for perspectives, talking about healthcare coverage, and those incredibly complicated things that have had us befuddled since we began talking about the ACA. And even before that, when you would just get a notice of premium increase from your healthcare provider, go, what is this? And some of the verbiage might be a little bit less than accessible. Reed joins us on line two. Thanks for your patience, Reed. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you, Tom. How you doing?
Hey, we're doing good, son. How about you?
Very well, very well. Because I have health care now.
Ah, that is right.
Thanks to the ACA. 2 years ago, I did not. And I worked for the Florida chain because I was in the what we call the income gap there, where I made so little money that I was Medicaid eligible, according to the federal government. Therefore, I didn't qualify for any subsidies. And so the plan, since we didn't expand Medicaid, the plans that were available to me were just out of reach. Now I'm in a much better situation personally, but there's still almost a million Floridians who are not. I'm wondering how your panel sees, in the wake of the King Burwell ruling and the fact that the president seems to have gotten his groove back on this issue a little bit, what's the prospect for next year's legislature, with the Senate pushing for Medicaid expansion? Is there any way we can push the House in that direction?
Well, let's see. I see a number of crystal balls being pulled out of briefcases and put on the table here. Let's go around and find out. John Howard, what do you think?
I tell you, politics is not my area of strength. All I know is what I read in the Tallahassee Democrat. But I did learn a lot this morning from these other two panelists this morning. They seem to be well connected. It does seem like at some point the state does have to it would seem to me there does have to be an exchange set up.
Well, it does increase, doesn't it, the overall cost when you have a large chunk of the population that has to rely on emergency room care, which is the most expensive form of care. That reverts back to people who are paying premiums for health coverage, which includes employers too, right?
That's always been the argument, I think, from the beginning. If we could get more people insured, more people paying premiums in to the insurance companies and HMOs, there would be less people without coverage. It just makes sense. So if we could get more people insured, it would seem to make sense that the cost would go down.
Okay. Congressman Altmaier, what do you think?
If you look at that 800,000 person group that lacks health insurance because of our inability to come to a political agreement on this, the employers do have a dog in this fight. It's easy to look at that group and say, well, that's not my problem. But they don't disappear. They still get sick. They still get injured. And they show up at the emergency room and they get treated. And somebody pays for it. They're not going to pay for it. But somebody pays. And that somebody is the people who have health insurance today. It's the employers. And when you hear about the cost increases, part of that increase is driven by the unintended consequence of the uncompensated care for people who don't have insurance today. The caller talks about the change in the public perception of the healthcare law. There has not been a change in the dynamic in Tallahassee. It's still going to be the same people in the House and the same people in the Senate, and they're going to hold the same position that they held 3 months ago, actually 1 month ago, when we were in the special session. And I just don't know that they're going to be able to come to agreement on this. I think absolutely there's agreement that we need to find a way to cover that population. There's no doubt that their hearts are in the right place. There's just a political disagreement on how's the best way to go about doing that.
Okay, Rosnett.
Well, I'm going to talk about two different groups. There is the estimated 800,000 who would qualify for the Medicaid under the Medicaid expansion if it were to be approved, and I agree with Jason's comments. But there's another significant group estimated to be another 850,000 who do not qualify for anything. The ACA does not provide coverage for them, and that is what is now almost a million ineligible non-citizens. But they're still in our state. They are still going to the emergency room, and all the things that Jason just cited apply to that group. So we're talking about combined 1.6, 1.7 million people.
And that latter category there, to clarify, since this had been part of that political discussion and to a degree now with the presidential campaigns in full swing here, that widespread perception that, well, undocumented folks are eligible somehow for coverage. And they're not, are they?
They are not.
All right, because that means that they also have to go to the emergency room, and that is – please, guys, correct me if I'm wrong. That is the most expensive form of medical care.
There's no doubt.
Right. Okay. So and someone pays for that, and now with the federal government, since we talked about this during the Medicaid expansion, the LIP, the low-income pool amount of money continuing to shrink, then that will revert again back to somebody, which will be premium payers, employers, that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's no way out of this, is there, that we can see right now?
The issue is not going to go away. I think costs could continue to go up. I do think that the market is much more – it's bigger than it was, clearly. A lot of people have gained coverage, but where you're – the ACA does not solve everything, and there are still issues.
About 18% of our gross domestic product is spent in some form of healthcare cost, and we're by far – I think the next industrialized nation is less than half of that. We've got to get a handle on that kind of expense.
And apparently it's going higher, John, because Larry Palivka with the Claude Pepper Foundation, who we were talking to the other night, said that as a portion of total expenditure for older folks, the 65-plus folks, it is soon going to 25%.
Yeah, it's the aging of population. People are living today to be 100 years old, and that's where a lot of that expense is coming from.
Let's see if Vivian can give us some additional input on line one. Hi, Vivian. Thanks for hanging on. Welcome to Perspectives.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for taking my call. I actually am changing my question because Medicaid was covered, but I wanted to say that I went through the health care exchange. I had had pre-existing conditions that has really haunted me for a very long time, and I was able to get covered, so I was pleased about that. But this is my question. There's been so much debate about the Affordable Care Act. At this point, does anybody on the panel have suggestions for a list of changes? If you could change one or two things about the Affordable Care Act as it's written now to make it better, because we all know it's a kind of a mess, more or less, what would the change be? And would those changes in time possibly get bipartisan support?
Oh, my. Well, that covers quite a field. Congressman, we'll start with you. You were part of the original. So
I could give you a very long list, but in deference to our other guests, I will not do that. But I would say an important component that needs to be addressed are the multiple layers of taxes that are in the bill to help fund the subsidies in the exchange. That money has to come from somewhere. It's about $1 trillion that is used to fund the subsidies in the exchange. Half of that, about $500 billion, comes from reductions in the Medicare program. We could talk about that. But the other half are tax increases. And some of those tax increases directly impact the elevation of the premiums in the cost. And that's the tax on health insurance, the tax on medical devices. Those are things that directly impact the rates that people are paying. So when you hear about this frustration that we're hearing from some of your callers, why are my rates going up? Some of that is directly related to the tax increases. So if we could find a way to get those out of the bill, that would help stabilize the price.
Okay. John Howard, what do you think?
A couple of thoughts. One is I read recently the Congressional Budget Office came up with an estimate that as much as billions of dollars, with a B, is being spent by the employers and administration having to deal with the laws associated with the Obamacare. When I work with the average employer each day and talk to them about what's required, it's very difficult for them to understand all the rules, regulations, to keep up with everything. On the other side of it, I don't think, not on the legislative side or the bill itself, but it's estimated that 50% of all medical expenses in our country are spent for only 5% of our population. There's so many areas like obesity and tobacco use, things like that. I think that's an area we really have to get a handle on in order to keep up, in order for there not to be so many expenses associated with health care.
And that was part of the ACA, too, to expand that preventive care component of overall health care. Rosenau.
Gosh, I think I would have just changed the implementation timeline and gotten the rules out faster and some of the other things. It was a very difficult time the first 2, 3, 4 years of doing the implementation, and there were so many questions. Most of that's cleared up now, so I don't have any really specific other than what the gentleman had said about changes going forward.
Mm-hmm. And I think most federal legislation has gone through a morphing or a modification period, whether it's Social Security or Medicare or some of the other programs that have been this broad and complex as the ACA. So what we see today is probably not what it's going to be in 10, 15, 20 years down the road. Probably.
Oh, absolutely. You're correct.
Okay. With the email here, guys, with the risk-cost corridor going away at the end of this year, what will we be left with? And someone needs to clarify exactly what is the risk-cost corridor.
So there, without getting too much into the weeds, there are provisions in the law where there are three levels of sharing of revenue that exists to help the insurance companies that have taken on greater risk, that have sicker people that they're covering. So generally paraphrased, the way it works is the insurance companies that have lower risk, that have healthier populations, and some would say have cherry-picked the market. I'm not saying that, but that was the argument that was made in drafting the law. they provide money into a pool that then goes to the insurance companies that have taken on greater risk and have sicker folks. Under the law, some of these provisions are phased out over time, over a three-year period in most cases. So yeah, once that goes away, then that's going to again have an impact on the way insurance companies market their product and design products, and it's going to have a direct impact on price, because if you have more sick people and you're not getting more money for it, you're going to have to price your product a lot higher, and that's going to have an impact.
And that was the whole idea really of the ACA though. And you'd said that too, John, when you expand that risk pool, which is the basic concept of insurance, going all the way back to Lloyd's of London, I guess, you spread out that risk. Everyone kicks in a little bit, and then when a catastrophe hits one member of the pool, well, then it doesn't become a total washout for them or anyone else. Everyone kicks in, and the broader the risk pool, the less everyone has to pay, right?
Yes, I think in the particular with that question, the concern on the insurance company's part was that someone might take on an incredible amount of expense. And so the way this corridor worked, as I understood it, after a year or two, everyone would be in the same place. Every insurance company would be the dust will have settled and the risk should not be different moving forward.
Okay. In theory.
In theory.
In theory.
Right.
We're talking about health care in the wake of the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision on the component of a.k.a. Obamacare that had to do with the subsidizing of policies under the federal exchange, which is what we have here in Florida, since we do not have a state exchange. Anything you'd like to share with our panel as far as a question or concern, give us a ring at 414-1234. And if it's long distance, 800-926-8809, perspectives at WFSU.org. And we shall return. What could be simpler and more understandable than healthcare coverage, huh? Especially over the debate and the acrimony of the past couple years over the Affordable Care Act and all the political rhetoric that's been thrown around. And now finally, maybe, perhaps, hopefully some clarity starts to emerge as we find out what the factual realities are of this whole thing. So that's what our panel's here to do today on Perspectives. And before we go back to the phones, Elaine, you hang on because you're going to be part of this too in just a second here. This whole idea, though, of cost containment, that if you get more people in the risk pool, if you get some more of these administrative things under control and fewer people going to the emergency rooms, it may be just conceivably the overall cost will start to, if not go down, at least not increase as greatly. John Howard, how do we get our handle on that, since this is a huge multi-billion dollar revenue stream, and where you have one of those, everyone wants to get their finger in there?
Yes, I think I come at it from a different perspective, maybe not directly answering your question, but education is such an important aspect of this whole thing. For example, we had one large employer. We were able to, through a self-insured process, examine the claims. And we saw one gentleman, for example, went to the emergency room 42 times in a calendar year. And he did that because he didn't understand the cost. When we met with him and talked about the difference in cost, he had a copay to the emergency room. So instead of going to a regular physician, the cost was like $1,000 per visit as opposed to maybe $100 a visit. Once we told him that, he said, of course, absolutely, I'd be happy to make a change. The cost of prescriptions, we're seeing someone go from like a capital health plan to a high deductible health plan. The deductible is $6,000. They've been paying $50 a month for a prescription, and they go to the pharmacy and it's now $600. Wait a minute, why is it $600? Well, it was always $600. The person just didn't know because CHP gave them a copayment. So when it comes to wellness, anytime we do anything in our country, we should analyze what it is we're doing, why, investigate options, and see if there are less expensive ways. Because in the long run, that's the only way we're going to reduce costs.
Okay. And from Big Blue's angle, Congressman, what do you think?
The largest driver by far of health care costs is pharmaceutical costs. The cost increases are double digits every year. We live in a world, and especially a country, where medical research has led to miraculous, life-saving, life-extending innovations and technologies. That's a wonderful thing. That costs money. And when you have a pill or a pharmaceutical product where it costs $1,000 a pill to take once a day for hepatitis C, that drives up costs for everybody. If you don't have hepatitis C, you're going to see a cost increase to pay for those who do that are using that pill. And you're only going to see more of that as time goes on. We have to find a way to address pharmaceutical costs. John also makes a great point with regard to price transparency. And this is one of the things at Florida Blue that we're very high on and focused on is giving transparency to our members so they can do some comparison shopping. They have an app where they can look at the hospitals and doctors for whatever procedure they want to have done, whether it be a general office visit or a specialty surgery, and they can compare prices. Right now, you can't do that, and healthcare and medicine is the only thing in business that you can't do some comparison shopping. And when you – studies have shown with regard to MRIs, for example, when you give that information to people, there are some insurance companies in the country that pay people to not go to the high-cost services. When you get an MRI, you pretty much know what the quality is going to be. It's going to be the same quality, but you might pay a lot more at one site than another. So you provide people that information. If you go to site A, you're going to pay this amount. If you go to site B, you're going to pay this amount. And the insurance company will pay you a little bit more to go to the lower cost setting. If you do that, on average, it saves $780 per MRI visit. $780. And there's 30 million MRIs that are done in a year. If you extend that out to the country, you're saving $20 billion to the healthcare system just by giving price transparency to the consumer, the example that John gave. So that individual knows he's going to get the same outcome, but he can go to the less costly setting, and that's going to save money for everyone.
Dr. Joe Blopp is having a special weekend appendectomy special. Call now to will we ever get to that, Rose Neff, do you think?
Well, I think that the industry has actually done some made some great strides in some cost containment. I mean, the capping of administrative spending is nationwide, narrow networks, trying to stay competitive. But we haven't changed human behavior. We haven't necessarily taught everybody who now has insurance the best way to use it. And I'm a big fan of the trend towards insurance consumerism, where we're reconnecting people with information about the real cost of healthcare. And I think that that is something that is going to take time for people to really hone in on.
Well, certainly not just cost as it relates to folks who are the users of health care, but also people who help to provide that health care, like Elaine. She's a small business owner, and let's go to her right now. Thanks for calling, Elaine. Welcome to Perspectives.
Thank you, Tom. This is a subject dear to my heart. I actually am a health care provider. I was a former small business owner. And the cost of health care is one of the reasons my business are contributed to the demise of my business. I just wanted to say that our legislature needs to do something about expanding health care for all those people in Florida that still have nothing. I was a big proponent for affordable health care. I wrote letters, I gave public presentations, and part of the reason is I had a sibling who developed cancer. She was diagnosed in the ER at Tampa General because she had no health care, though she had worked her whole life. So offering health care to people is something that will make our whole society better, and I appreciate the discussion that I've heard. It's very relevant, important. There's a lot of education that needs to be done. But I did just want to say that we do need to work on expanding health care for other Floridians.
Oh, Elaine, sorry about your sister and also the demise of your business, and thanks so much for sharing that, which maybe brings us to another more elemental question. Why is it that of all the industrialized nations, we treat healthcare as some kind of a luxury add-on to life here rather than a basic part of human need? John?
I wish I had the answer to that. I don't know. It does seem to me that healthcare is one of those things that is expected. And meaning to have health coverage, but the cost associated with having with that is so much higher than every other nation. I don't understand the difference.
Yeah, and Congressman, you went through all that too. I mean, you looked at comparative ways of providing health care, whether it's Canada or Europe or any other nation, and somehow you know we insist on doing it differently, and yet it doesn't seem to be better.
It's not just with health care, but it's just the American ideal. It's the American way of doing things where we like to do it our way in America. I think supporters of the Affordable Care Act would argue that the perception of whether or not it's a right to have health care has changed with regard to having the Affordable Care Act in place. But if you look at the political dynamic that occurred when the health care debate was taking place until Senator Kennedy died, there was a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, 60 votes that would have passed anything. There was 80-seat majority of Democrats in the House, and you had a newly elected Democratic president that was working to do as much as he possibly could on this. And if in that climate they still couldn't do a European-style government-run healthcare system, they're never going to be able to find the popular support in America to do that. There's just a level of discomfort among Americans with government intervention to something so personal to them as healthcare.
Yeah, even if they can't afford it, and as a result of not having it, you have loved ones who prematurely die. I mean, we're all going to get sick, right, Rose?
Oh, absolutely. Had some health issues myself. And I don't – not that I am proposing this, but as Americans, why do we expect everything to be covered? You know, when you buy homeowners insurance, you're not asking them to cover the painting of the house and the redoing of the roof and the mowing of the lawn. So there's some sort of unreasonable expectation about what health insurance should be covering.
Certainly, yeah. Not a one-size-fits-all or we want everything for free. But, also the mowing of the lawn maybe shouldn't cost $85,000. I don't know. Congressman.
You know what else a key point, and this Rose reminds me of this, it depends on where your life circumstance is, how you feel about the health care law at any given time. And you think about the rhetoric that occurred in the debate over the ACA. And we no longer discriminate – some would use the term discriminate – based upon gender. It used to be you could, as an insurance company, charge women and men different prices. Now that is prohibited under the law. It's illegal to do that. But the fact is younger women have higher health care costs than younger men. That's a fact. Now, it's also a fact that younger men are equally responsible for why younger women have higher health care costs, right? But over the course of one's lifetime, that flips. And older women have lower health care costs than older men. So the reason that was able to be put into the law in a relatively non-controversial fashion is because the argument was made over the course of one's lifetime, everything has a way of kind of equaling out.
Yeah. John.
I was just sitting here thinking about a year ago today, roughly, I was woke up with a pain in my side and I went to urgent care and they weren't sure exactly what it was. And I went across the street to TMH, to the emergency room. And within just a very short period of time, they told me I had an emergency appendectomy, which needed to be done. I was wheeled into the operating room and I was gone the next morning by about 7 o'clock. It was amazing that we live in a country that I can have all that at my disposal. But about 2 weeks later, I got a bill for $25,000. That was not the paid amount. But that's, to me, when you said a minute ago, Jason, it depends on where you are. At that moment, you don't care what it costs. You want relief or healing or whatever it might be. So it's expensive.
Yeah, and that is what we've gotten used to, that someone else – you were saying that, Rose. Someone else kind of takes care of that so we don't have to worry about it, right?
Right. And that separation – I mean, you were in pain, I'm sure – and you didn't want to talk about what the bill was going to be or if there was a less expensive place to get that done.
It never even came up at that
exactly.
point.
Exactly. And I do think it's important. Emergencies are maybe a little bit different, but in using the primary care system or specialty care when there's not an urgent and painful situation, we need to do more to educate people on how to use their healthcare services and the time to use it. It's in the see the primary care doctor, get your checkups, those kinds of things.
That whole preventive care thing, which
yes.
is just absolutely critical and thankfully was built into the ACA, at least that is covered. And also, we didn't even get into the situation of people with pre-existing conditions, which was a major change in the way that we look at healthcare in this country. Otherwise, again, full disclosure, with both wife and daughter cancer survivors, they would not have health insurance today if that were not part of the whole deal. You're right, Rose. We could talk for another 2 hours, couldn't we, here? Just in the few minutes we have left, just a quick summation. Where do we go from here, John? What do you think lies ahead for the average client here of Rogers Gunner Vaughn Insurance, an employer that has whether it's 5 or 75 employers? They're just going to look at increasing health care costs, or will we mitigate here over the next couple of years, or what do you see?
Well, on the employer side, I do see a lot of changes. For example, January 1st of this year, a large employer goes from 50 employees to 100. And that's going to make a lot of changes to the plan designs that are available to employers. Again, that's the area that I work in. And so that's where I'm speaking to your question. But I think that is going to have a huge impact on cost because for the first time, instead of having every employee with the same rate, every employee will now have a different rate. And in some cases, that can cause a considerable increase in cost.
Wow. Jason Altmaier, what do you think?
What you're going to see now in the private market is insurers and providers, doctors and hospitals and health insurance, for the first time sitting on the same table, sitting on the same side of the table, talking about aligning incentives to improve quality and lower costs. So instead of sitting across from each other arguing over who's going to pay for what, now we're working together to find ways to lower the cost of care and increase the quality for the consumer. Because as I talked about, that was the missing component in the law. So at Florida Blue, we're working to create accountable care organizations, patient-centered medical homes. These are mechanisms where we work with doctors and hospitals to agree upon a target to increase that quality and lower the cost at the end of the year. And we're making great progress in that. And in the end, who's the biggest beneficiary of that? It's the healthcare consumer because they're getting a higher quality product at a lower cost.
Great. Rose Neff.
I'm watching the trend, this slow but starting to grow shift from defined benefit where an employer picks a company and a benefit plan and tells the employees this is it to the defined contribution model. Some major large employers are moving in that direction and it's predicted to continue to grow. And in that situation, an employer maybe will pick a company. But there will be 4 plan options for employees to pick from. Employers would say, I'm going to give you X dollars. You buy what you want. I think that's a trend. That is certainly a trend I'm watching, and I think it's has a lot of positives for it. You know, why did employers take responsibility for our healthcare decisions by picking our plans for us? One of the reasons I think this is growing is employers don't need to be in that business. They want to be in the business of running their business and not being responsible. And another thing that happens is a good number of employees, when this kind of plan is offered, buy down. We've been giving them more than they felt they need in their healthcare choices. And I think that's a really important thing to recognize.
Sort of like a modified, what do you call it, healthcare savings account or something. But here it would be the employer would be setting up an account like that.
Right. Here's your you get $400 a month and you can buy what you want. And here, you know, you get 4 or 5 choices.
And is the name of your organization, Change is Good, and Choice is Good too.
Absolutely. I do think choice is very good.
Rose Neff, CEO of Florida Health Choices, we really appreciate your coming on and adding so much to the conversation today. Jason Altmaier, former congressman from the 4th District of Pennsylvania, which sadly is no longer with us anymore, and senior vice president of Florida Blue, thank you for what you brought to the discussion today and for being especially part of what actually brought the ACA to fruition.
Thank you. I was glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And also John Howard with Rogers Gunter Vaughn Insurance right here in Tallahassee and major provider of plans to employer groups throughout the Big Bend. Good to have you on.
Thank you, sir. Tom. It was a pleasure.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Taylor Cox and Lido Rawls doing the deed back there. And I'm Tom Flanagan. Next Thursday, I'm taking a little time off from the microphones. Regan McCarthy will be taking you into the gardens and fields for a delicious look at the growing grow-it-yourself food movement in our area. Please join us for our next Perspectives right here on WFSU-FM.
Audio copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.